to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Locusts, grasshoppers, and crickets. That's what people in Canmore were talking about at the 9th International Conference of the Orthopterist Society. Scientists from around the world gathered to share their latest findings on these insects and what they could do to improve the management of outbreaks to prevent famine and economic ruin. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Grasshoppers are everywhere. They munch their way across the southern prairie, and this summer they were even prevalent in northern gardens. All around the world, grasshoppers and their swarming cousins, the locusts, can cause all kinds of damage when they get out of control. More than 120 scientists gathered recently in Canmore at the foot of the Rocky Mountains to discuss their latest research on these insects, and that was at the 9th International Conference of the Orthopterist Society. Hosted by the University of Lethbridge, the conference was organized by Canada's best-known grasshopper expert, Dr. Dan Johnson.
Interestingly enough, like the orthoptera themselves, the reasons are very diverse. The first one that gets people's attention is money and death. You know, those things matter. And famine, a lot of famine is caused by locusts. A lot of people are suffering malnutrition because of locusts. Nations spend a lot of money, international agencies spend money to control locusts. So locusts is a big part of it. Another is economic losses caused by grasshoppers, the relatives of the locusts. Another area is climate change, interestingly enough. Grasshoppers and locusts are very sensitive in different ways entirely back and forth to climate and to weather. Studying the orthoptera will tell us about weather variability and climate change. And the other side of that is that as climate does change, we will have big repercussions in the grasshopper and locust world. Some grasshoppers will become rare. Some will become extremely common and have outbreaks and infestations much more frequently and perhaps earlier in the season. So that's an area of research. Another area of research is behavioral research. There's all kinds of interesting things you can study with respect to their mate. Finding strategies and their singing and their feeding and their movement, their migration makes a good subject. There's a lot of neurophysiology done with crickets and grasshoppers and locusts. A great deal of evolutionary biology invested in grasshoppers and locusts. And we find out how life on Earth has come to be by studying grasshoppers and locusts. So there's a long list of things people study, but we all study the same group, the Orthoptera, so we get together.
I'm finding it quite interesting, the different talks and also the approaches that people are taking. For instance, this morning there was a fellow talking about how grasshoppers can morph into locusts just by having their back legs rubbed. And then there's a fellow right now who's talking about grasshoppers and locusts from the point of view of waging war. And then there's the ethics of dealing with these. Why is there such a range of the sort of different perspectives on them?
Part of the answer is because scientists are people, but I guess that's the obvious answer, and we all have different approaches. But the other is about the Orthoptera. Some of them are the most negative creatures on Earth from our perspective, perhaps, but others are also extremely positive and very valuable. A lot of ecosystems are founded on insects as food items for birds or organisms that turn over nutrients and keep the ecosystem going. They're part of biodiversity, a very big part. If you look at grassland, for example, Africa, China, Canada, the U.S., it's not really the antelope and the cattle that are the big grazers. It's things like the grasshoppers. And there's so much biomass going through them, and they're supporting such a food web above them that this positive value really has to be recognized and studied, and that's part of it. So yeah, we love them, we hate them, they're valuable, they take from us. These are the reasons that we have so many diverse needs for research. But then the diverse approaches are as broad as you can imagine. If you can find a new approach that no one has taken, and if it really will yield new knowledge that's valuable, particularly valuable to society, which is what science is all about, great. And that's why we have so many people doing so many different things.
What is Alberta and Canada's contribution to research in this area?
Just the fact of the matter is that Canada has a lot of grasshopper problems over the years. Since the 20s, they've recognized this as a big problem. They've always had an interest in whether or not certain grasshoppers that attack crops will arise and have several years of high numbers or not. So there are surveys. There is some research, certainly, on more environmentally sustainable methods of grasshopper control. Canada invested a lot of money into a program in Africa, for example, to develop biological control of grasshoppers. In Canada, we have been doing that for 20 years. We're working on biological control of grasshoppers, and we have some very, very good candidates, so much so that the problems are really industrial problems and regulatory problems more than biology, although there's plenty of room for that, and I'm pushing that as a biologist and a biogeographer. But Alberta is a big center for a lot of that grasshopper damage and so on.
As the organizer of this conference, what do you want to see come out of it?
Well, I had a couple of objectives. One is service to the scientific society, and that drives a lot of what scientists do. So that was half of my purpose. The other half was to actually promote the kind of orthopteran research I want to see done. I'm working on sustainable grassland ecosystems. I'd like to see management systems that are based on science, and not just based on whims or old booklets or economics. We need to put it all together, and we need to have methods of pest control, for example, or water treatment and so on that last and serve not only society but also the maintenance of the ecosystems. And that's the kind of grasshopper control, for example, I'd like to see. I mean, I'm looking at a lot of other things in my present position, but that's one of them. When an outbreak comes along, millions of liters of pesticide are used. Are we sure they're the right ones? Are we sure they're used in the right ways, in the right places? There's not really a lot of monitoring going on. Maybe we should look at some research to try to make it foolproof and find things that don't have these problems. So that's some of the, it's maybe not my main area of work, but it's one of my areas, and I'm hoping to hear some of that in this meeting.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Well, thank you for coming all the way out to Canmore.
That was Dr. Dan Johnson of the University of Lethbridge. He holds a Canada Research Chair in Grassland Ecology. One of the keynote speakers at the 9th International Conference of the Orthopterous Society was Dr. Stephen Simpson. While at Oxford University in England, Stephen started what became known as the Oxford Project. His objective was to find out what caused a lowly grasshopper in North Africa to suddenly morph into the deadly, swarming desert locust.
Well, we found out lots of things. Among the first things we found out was that the stimuli that are provided by other locusts that cause you to change are being touched by others, and in particular, being touched on your back leg. And so we did a series of extremely sophisticated experiments where we took a paintbrush and tickled locusts on various body regions, and in that way pinpointed the site of stimulation which causes or triggers the shift from non-locust to locust behavior, and found that that was a patch of hairs on the back leg of the animal. And we also went on to show that when the mother lays her eggs in the soil, which she does in a pod in the soil, if she's recently been crowded, she adds a chemical to the eggs that causes them to develop into the swarming form rather than the non-swarming form. And I guess the other major thing we've discovered is that whether or not a local population of locusts will be brought together long enough to interact with each other, tickle each other's legs, bumping into each other, to flip them into the aggregating swarming form, is a function of how food plants are distributed in the environment. So if they're well dispersed, locusts can avoid each other. If they're clumped, then they can't. And that allows you to predict which particular habitats will support or at least make more likely the occurrence of a swarming event.
Why is this important for grasshoppers to turn into locusts like this?
It's important for locusts because you ought to be behaving differently and generally equipped differently if you're going to find yourself on your own than if you find yourself in a group. So if you're on your own you want to be camouflaged. You want to be green in color so you blend in with your background. You don't want to draw attention to yourself. You want to move slowly and cautiously. And if you come across other locusts, unless it happens to be breeding season, you want to avoid them. Now, that all makes sense. If you're in a crowd, on the other hand, it's better to gang together and to be brightly colored because you're then more visually arresting and you're more likely to deter predators. And you, when you're in a crowd, when you do move, as you'll need to when you run out of food, is you want to move together. You don't want to start getting dispersed, because if you're brightly colored and obvious and you're on your own, then you're in trouble. So you better stick together with others. So it's a whole suite of different things that collectively mean that you're better adapted to life in a group or better adapted to life on your own. And the animal needs the evidence as to which of those is the case. Am I on my own or am I in a group? And the way it turns out they detect the latter is by being touched on their back legs sufficiently frequently to make it evident that you're in a group.
Does this relate to changes in the environment? These locusts are on the desert, but every once in a while things do green up and there's lots of food around.
Well, that's precisely right. And you can imagine the time course. Let's say you're living under, as these animals do in North Africa, very, very barren conditions. There's not much food. There are little scattered patches of vegetation. The best thing you can do is to pretend you're not there, to be well camouflaged, because there's going to be very few of you and the environment doesn't support your being brightly colored. It's not a good idea. But then again, as you say, if it rains, then there are all these dormant propagules in the soil, spring to life, the environment greens up, and lots more locusts can live in such a world without drawing attention to themselves, and that's what happens. You get a build-up in the population, and so you can get many locusts now all pretending they're not there, which is fine because there's a clothing, an even clothing of vegetation over the landscape. But then it dries up, goes back to being a desert, and as that happens, the animals get concentrated against their predisposition to avoid each other, and as they get concentrated, they bump into each other, and that triggers them to change into the other form. And by swarming and then migrating, that helps them to get out of an area of declining quality and find somewhere better.
One of the terms you used in your presentation was synchronicity in relation to how the locusts actually move. And I think of locusts in the biblical sense as a plague, you know, moving, blackening the sky and causing all kinds of havoc. Why synchronicity? Where does that fit in?
Well, one of the key issues is if you're going to form an aggregation and you're going to need to move from where you are to somewhere else, you want to do it all together. You don't want to have some of you moving before the others, because then they become separated from the crowd, and that's dangerous. So what you want is for everybody to do the same thing at the same time. So you need some synchronizing of the behavior. So when you're feeding, everybody should be feeding. When you're moving, you all should be moving together. So synchronicity is very important, and that could be provided either by animals cueing each other. So when one starts to eat, it releases the smell of nice chewed plants, which stimulates its neighbor to start eating, and so on. And it could be through mutual interactions. And the other source of synchrony is the environment. So every morning the sun comes up, and so they all come down, they descend from their roost, which is typically the vegetation where they've been roosting overnight. They come down and they bask in the sun to warm up, and they'll do that all at the same time together. And when they've warmed up, which they'll typically do all around the same time, then they start moving together. So synchronicity is critical in getting maintaining cohesion within a group. And that's a critical aspect, a critical function of being in a group, because if you start to get dispersed, you're no longer in a group, and you then suffer the consequences.
Can they turn back into what they were before?
Yes. If the animal experiences a change in its population density, it will start to return to the other form. So hence, if you've been in a crowd for a long time, and then you find yourself on your own, initially you start to change back again. So providing you are maintained on your own, you have to start to behave appropriately, otherwise you will be eaten. So what they do is they start to become less active, and over time, as they develop, they return to the solitary condition. As they molt, they go through different stages and they shed their skin. They'll change their color from black and yellow back to green, and vice versa. If you're used to being on your own and you suddenly find yourself in a crowd, then you can change into the crowded form, at least to a substantial degree within your own life.
What would be the relevance of what you've discovered then in your research to management of locus?
Well, I think the key thing that we've been able to do is provide a tool for better predicting which environments will trigger outbreaks and what particular conditions will provide, if you like, danger signals for an outbreak occurring. And that will enable, if you have the right structure for taking advantage of that information, that will enable you to nip a problem in the bud, and it's a problem that gets exponentially greater with time. So the most recent outbreaks in North Africa, it was literally a period of 2 months within which they went from being very low population, scattered populations, to being huge outbreaks, the biggest that we've seen for the last 15 years.
Are there any lessons here for other species of animals?
Well, there's the very general issue, and an incredibly important one, that animals have to learn, and I use learning advisedly here, they can either learn within their own lifetime or learn, in inverted commas, through genetic selection over generations, to deal with variability in their environment. The world isn't a fixed place, so animals enter the world with an expectation embodied in their design through natural selection that the world will be variable. There'll be things that will happen. Stuff will happen. Certain things are more predictable than others. And what we see here in locusts is an extreme form of that. So the locust, over its evolutionary history, has evolved two forms, or two sets of clothes, if you like. One of them is appropriate to being in a crowd, and the other is appropriate to being on your own. And the world you live in can be in one of either of those two conditions, but which it will be in, you can't predict. So you need to be ready to respond by having both sets of clothes available. So that's a very, very important general issue. There's been a view, perhaps an extreme view, that genes control how animals are in a very direct, hardwired way. Well, in fact, what's becoming more and more understood is that genes control a set of flexible responses in animals, which can be behavioral, or they can be morphological, or they can be all sorts of things. And the way in which genes relate to flexibility in the phenotype, or the form and function of the animal, and how that relates to the structure of the environment, its predictability in particular, is one of the really key issues in modern biology.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
That was Dr. Stephen Simpson. He's a Federation Fellow at the University of Sydney in Australia and a visiting professor at the University of Oxford. He was in Canmore recently speaking at the 9th International Conference of the Orthopterist Society. Another of the distinguished guests at the 9th International Conference of the Orthopterist Society in Canmore was Dr. Bill Cade. Not only is Bill president of the University of Lethbridge, he's a world-renowned expert on crickets and the developmental biology of insects. I asked Bill what made him a cricket man.
Years ago, when I was a graduate student at the University of Texas, crickets were especially common that summer. They flew in very, very large numbers, landing under streetlights. And the man I ended up working with, who was a grasshopper expert, said to me one day, "Why don't you do a PhD on crickets?" And I said, "Sure, why not?" I just sort of fell into it.
We have a lot of grasshoppers in Alberta, but do we have that many crickets here?
We've got a pretty good cricket fauna. It depends on the year. How wet the year is really the main thing. And on really cool evenings, they don't sing. They'll switch over to a daytime behavior. But in the south, around Lethbridge, it's just been a bumper crop year for crickets with all the rain we've had. I should say, I do study crickets, but my main interest is the evolution of mating behavior in insects. And crickets have just been real good to do that on.
Now, why is that?
You can raise them in the laboratory. We raise them by the thousands, and we feed them Purina cat chow, and they're very easy to raise, and they do interesting things, including they sing. And because they have a song, that's a lot of our focus has been around the song. And then they have, as we discovered a few years ago, they have an enemy, a parasitic fly, that listens to them. And that just added an increased level of complexity to the whole system.
Well, are they like birds? They have different songs for different things?
Yeah, they do. They're like birds in that each species has a different song, so you can identify the species by the song. And then for males, only male crickets sing, females don't. That's a difference with some birds. Males have a calling song, which is the rhythmic one we associate with summer evenings. That attracts females. They have an aggressive song, which they use when they fight with other males. And they have a courtship song, which sounds like a very soft rustling of leaves, which they use once they've actually touched a female with their antennae, and that entices her to, so to speak, entices her to mate.
Can you take any of that and sort of apply it to other insect species?
Well, I think so. I mean, to begin with, that's a basic description of crickets across the board, and there's probably about 10,000 crickets. I think it probably has implications for how mating systems operate generally. Males often perform displays. Females evaluate males based on their displays. And there's usually somebody else involved, either a predator or a parasite of some kind.
You're here at the Ornithopterists Society meeting, and the University of Lethbridge is one of the sponsors. And you're also co-chairing a session on Friday, which has to do with developmental behavior. What are some of the concerns there?
Well, the session on Friday has to do with the way in which males compete for females and the way in which females evaluate males. So it's really the area of research that I've done. And we've drawn mostly young people that have recently entered their careers, brand new PhDs, some of them brand new assistant professors. And we wanted to emphasize what young people are doing in the field this year. And so we've got an array of people from all over the world that are going to be talking about their research. And I think it's going to be a fascinating morning.
The sessions are dealing with sexual selection. What is new in this area?
Well, I should say it's a pretty old area. It even goes back to Aristotle's time, but Darwin formalized it with his book in 1871 on sexual selection. And in that book, Darwin laid out a scenario by which males of a species, and that's many, many species of animals, tend to compete for females who are especially picky or choosy in their choice of mates. And males compete by being brightly colored, or in case of crickets, they compete by producing loud noises that females evaluate males based on. And so what was new years ago was an explanation of why it is the males are usually the ones that are the competitive ones, and females are usually the ones that evaluate the other sex. And it sort of comes down to females have a great deal to lose by mating with a dud male because they produce very expensive eggs. And males have very little to lose because sperm are cheap to produce. That's a very generalization. And so we end up with a world, be it birds or mammals or whatever you want, where generally speaking, the males have been forced into a form of competition for females that are fairly picky in their choice of mates.
How does that play out in the cricket or grasshopper field?
Well, crickets, we were talking earlier about song. Grasshoppers are mostly visual creatures, and they compete by a visual signaling. They'll shake different parts of their body. They'll wave legs at a female. They do produce song, but they're not nearly as singy or acoustical as male crickets. But over the last few years, what people have really become interested in is what's the role of sexual selection in the creation of new species, in the hiving off of one species that turns into other species with time. And so we have a young woman, Tamara Mendelson, who's at Lehigh University, and she's a brand new PhD. And she's been working on a species of cricket that inhabits the Hawaiian Islands called Laupala, which means brown lava, and they tend to occur in the lava tubes of the islands. And she has found that they're creating species faster than almost any other animal on the planet. And it seems to be based upon females picking particular sorts of male characteristics that then they pass on to their sons and daughters, and thus starting to form new species over time. So we're real interested in that. Then there's a whole array of exceptions to males competing and females being choosy. There are some male insects that actually feed females large proteinaceous masses when they mate. And so that means that the male's spending more than just sperm cells on mating. He's actually spending a lot of energy in producing this food mass. So I guess what's new, to come back to your question, is that Darwin was pretty much right, but there are exceptions that probably are more interesting than the run-of-the-mill, which is crickets calling and females choosing.
Well, I'm curious about this business of creating new species. How do you know when you've gone far along enough that you can say, well, this is a new species?
That's a real good question, and it's probably one that's puzzled biologists for a long time. One way, of course, empirically, is to try to mate the two. So if you go through the Hawaiian forest and you find a Laupala that is producing a single pulse a second, so it's going jit, jit, and then you come along and you find another one that's going cheet. Most of us would say it's probably a different species, but to prove it, you have to take it into the laboratory and try to cross the females of the one that calls more often with the males of the ones that call one a second. And when you do that, they don't cross, so they have been isolated enough that they form new species. But what Dr. Mendelson has done is to go a step further and to look at their DNA and to see how far their DNA has diverged over time. So it's a really good question, and it's a hard one to answer.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Bill Cade, president of the University of Lethbridge and a professor of biological sciences there. He was one of the many researchers attending the 9th International Conference of the Orthoptera Society in Canmore. I also spoke with Dr. Dan Johnson and Dr. Stephen Simpson. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, the Alberta Research Council, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatic Circle of Research Excellence, the Alberta Conservation Association, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Innovation and Science, the Alberta Gaming Research Institute, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.